Hey, Anna, big news last month. I know you were super excited about the transit of Mercury that happened on November 11th. Where were you? What happened? What'd you see?
I was at the Cincinnati Observatory viewing through one of the oldest public telescopes still in use in the world. Where were you is the question.
Well, we'll get to that. No grilling me yet. That's coming up. But
it was amazing, that tiny dot.
Wasn't that cool, though?
I was looking at the wrong dot for a while, and one of the volunteers had to be like, nope, that's a piece of dirt. You need to look. Mercury is teensy, man.
Isn't it? I mean, I was so glad it got cleared up here in Cincinnati.
Just for an hour. Yeah.
And yeah, to look through the oldest telescope in the United States through a hydrogen alpha filter, seeing like prominences on the sun.
Totally.
And this tiny little dot. I mean, was it all that it was cracked up to be? I hyped it pretty good.
And then you left town. Yes. It was everything you said it would be.
I know. I'm totally
I'll never
crushed.
Let you forget this. I'm totally sorry.
I left.
It was wonderful. And a lot of the public came and saw it too. Actually, they scurried over when it ended up being clear. People came over.
Leaving town, it hurt. It hurt me.
I feel bad about it actually.
I couldn't risk it. I didn't. It was going to be 99% cloud cover the whole time. So I skedaddled. But I'll save that for the.
That's the teaser.
We'll keep the viewers hanging out to see what happened.
There you go.
From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory, where Dean's the astronomer and I can handle the truth. On this episode, we're excited to talk with scientist, podcaster, SpaceX mission manager, and author of Beyond the Known, Andrew Rader. Well, so the transit, you've been looking forward to it. How long would you say you've been looking forward to the transit?
I was thinking about that. When I started in astronomy, it was 1998. Mm-hmm. And I remember first learning about transits about 1999 when I was studying them. And of course, I wanted to see, well, when's the next one?
Right.
So there was a series of cloudy ones. And then we had one in 2016 in May. Which is, May in Cincinnati is often good weather.
But it wasn't.
It was not. It was cloudy everywhere. So I vowed at that day that I was not going to miss the next one because it was 2019, 3 years.
Right.
If I missed that one, I would have to go to the Eastern Hemisphere in 2032.
Dang.
And I like traveling in America. I don't like traveling overseas. It's just the planes. I can't do the planes.
You're like, I don't like to do air travel.
It's just too far. So I was like, this is it. I'm going 2019. And so I looked at the weather. The weather in Cincinnati was terrible.
When was the last time you checked the weather before you made your decision? I'm just curious.
Every 10 minutes.
Every
10 minutes. I did searches. So then I said, okay, where can I drive to that's nearby?
Yeah.
Columbus, Ohio. Cleveland. All cloudy. Pittsburgh cloudy, Detroit cloudy, Chicago, St. Louis, Iowa, Louisville, Lexington, all cloudy.
Uh-huh.
So the closest spot that was going to be clear was Knoxville, Tennessee. And even then, it was only kind of a so-so chance.
It's like a four-hour drive.
It's a four-and-a-half-hour drive.
My gosh.
That's right. So I packed up the car, packed up all the telescopes, the filters, everything like that, and trekked down to Knoxville the night before.
Oh, you did? I didn't realize you went the night before. Okay.
No, I went the night before because it starts in the morning. It started at 7:30.
Okay, sorry. He looked at me like I was crazy, y'all. He's like, it starts in the morning,
sorry,
early.
I was a little obsessed. I know. It's possible I was slightly, okay, slightly wrapped up in this.
Slightly.
And there is something called transit fever. This really affected, you laugh. I'm deadly serious.
Transit fever.
Transit fever.
Oh, I've come down with a bad case of the old TF.
That's
transit
right.
fever.
It affected astronomers in the 1700s and 1800s. They would risk it all to go to see these transits. There's these tragic stories of people that wasted their lives in fruitless searches for transits.
Oh, that's so sad.
It is. And so here I was. I was like, well, the least I can do is go to Knoxville. I mean, that's, you know. That's
if not, I have to.
If that's not so bad.
Oh, my gosh.
But I woke up. It was foggy. Foggy. And so I missed the very beginning, and I was about to pack the car up and go farther south.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, I got to go farther south then. If I have to drive to Florida, I'm going to drive to Florida. Oh, so I ate a little breakfast, and then the fog was starting to lift. So I got encouraged. And so I unloaded the car right there in the parking lot at the Super 8. You know, very high class.
A super 8. Yeah. You couldn't even have gone like Hilton Garden Suites.
Well, yeah, transit fever got me.
Saw the first hotel, motel. And you were like, doing it.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm setting up in the parking lot, 8 o'clock in the morning.
Are people looking at you?
A little.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was off to the side a little bit, so I didn't want to draw too much attention.
Oh,
but
my God.
So I had this, you know, three telescopes set up with filters.
What do you need three telescopes for?
I went overboard.
Oh my God, this is transit fever.
Yeah. So, but I wanted to test out what the smallest amount of magnification you need.
Okay.
Because Mercury is so tiny, you need to magnify about 20 or 30 times, like, minimum.
Okay.
So I brought a little extra. You know, bring the big guns too. So
sure, you and three telescopes driving south
in the middle of parking lot
in a Super 8 Knoxville.
So So then the fog started to lift, and I could see the disk of the sun up in the sky. I had the filter on the big scope, and it was still misty. And it was coming across. The clouds were coming across. I was like, "Where is it? Where is it?" And then all of a sudden, I saw the disk very clearly.
It was the tiniest little dot there.
And I paused. I was like. My breath left me for a second because I know it sounds crazy. So it really does.
I've known Dean for like 5 years. He's the top five most excited I've ever heard him is maybe right now.
That's
actually.
Right. That's right.
It's like
it
giddy.
It took my breath away. Like, this little dot.
It's and so I
don't
lovely.
Know, I don't know if it was the intense hardship of driving all the way to Knoxville, Tennessee.
Sleeping on a super mattress.
The fog, the bad breakfast that I had there. And then when it just appears, it wasn't an easy. So
you worked for it.
I worked for it.
And meanwhile, then, I just walked over to the bed. I'm just kidding.
I know. So then I'm like tweeting out some pictures. And then Kelsey from work was like, yeah, we're looking at it right now. You're in Cincinnati. So I'm standing in the parking lot thinking, boy, this is my life.
Did anybody else like come over like, what you looking at there, boy?
I had only, just, is that your Tennessee
that
accent?
Tennessee
that was pretty good.
Boy?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, nobody said that.
Okay.
I had two people come up to me. They were two of the hotel employees. They were,
please, sir, could you pack this up and get it out of here?
They were checking the rooms. They're cleaning the rooms. Uh-huh. And they're going past. They're looking at me sideways. Like, what's this guy?
Did you invite him over to look
I was like, yeah, you want to, I don't know what to say. I was
always
like, do you
educator.
Want to see the transit of Mercury? I had to think of like a better.
You sounded like a yahoo.
I know, I need a better hook than that. I was like, I'm looking at the sun. There's something really cool happening. And they came over and they looked and they're like, oh yeah, that's good. They were not.
They weren't as into it as you.
No.
They weren't ready to drive south with you to see the
not
next.
To see
okay.
Farther. Yeah. So, so then from there, I stayed there for a few hours because it's 5.5 hours long. And so I decided, well, I might as well start heading back home. Now, since it's clear in Cincinnati, I might as well head back home. So I started up north, watched some from the rest area in Kentucky, and then the rest of it south of Berea, where I got to see the very end of it, where Mercury just leaves the surface of the sun and returns the blackness of space. And so that was it. I got to see all the way to the end. And
you did it.
Yep, I did it.
You really made that happen.
I did it. And
wow.
So, yep. So 2032, next one will be in Europe and Asia and Africa.
Oh,
there'll be another one, I think.
Which planet? Who's transiting
Mercury,
who there?
Mercury, still Mercury.
Oh, Mercury again.
And then another Mercury transit, I think 2039. And then then the next one in the U.S. is 2049.
Okay,
that was
right.
The big thing. I didn't want to wait another 30 years. That'd be ridiculous.
Yeah.
So
insane.
So I did it.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
The only thing similar is the transit of Venus that happened. We had two transits of Venus earlier in the 21st century. It was 2004, 2012.
Okay.
And I was a little nutso about the 2004 one.
Like, why? I mean, of course you were.
I got the fever.
God.
I'd been reading about all those.
You need to calm down.
I know. I'd been reading about all those like bad stories about and I did all these classes about the transit. And so I drove to New Hampshire to see that
one. You drove to New Hampshire?
To get an extra 30 minutes. Yeah. So with the transit. And I was met by fog there also. And my friend that I was with there, I probably scared her because we were in the car looking at the ocean with the fog, no sun. And
you were like freaking out.
I said, excuse me, I need to step outside for a second. And I stepped outside and I yelled at the universe. I was like, no, you can't do this. This is, I want to see this. Yeah, you know, I mean, I was crazy. And then I know. This is what it gets. This is what happens to you.
I
yelled at
the universe.
I was like,
that it wasn't fair that you weren't able to see the transit of Venus.
Yes, and it worked because the fog lifted and I
it hurt
to see
you.
It. Yeah, it hurt me.
Oh wow.
Yep. So, yep. It gets hold of you. You gotta watch out for that. I'm telling you.
Yeah. No. Sure.
The eclipse chasers. That's one.
Eclipse. Maybe that's like a phenomenon.
Well,
the transits.
But eclipses happen more often. So you're gonna have eclipses every couple of years. But transits is you gotta go 30 years or so.
And you were like not gonna. You made it happen though.
I did. And
you gotta get it. Give you credit for that.
So I'm very ambitious to see the next transit of Venus. Which will be in the year 2119. I'm very ambitious that I'm going to make it.
How is that even humanly possible?
Oh, I'm going to find a way. 100 years from now?
Transit fever is going to keep you propelled to the age of 100 and whatever.
Whatever I am, yeah.
That's right.
I'm motivated.
Wow.
They're going to...
We are vegetarians, so you're eating healthy.
They'll wheel me out there and I'll say, keep looking up.
Keep looking up. And then you'll just like... right there. That's all you need. You're like,
moment.
I did it.
2119.
I feel like I took it for granted now. Now I'm going to be more appreciative of what I was able to see.
That's good.
You've taught me.
So, man, I used to think I was busy, but now I've learned about our guest, Andrew Rader. He's got his PhD in aerospace engineering from MIT, won the Discovery Channel's competitive show, Canada's Greatest Know-It-All, works as a mission manager for SpaceX, co-hosts a podcast called Spellbound with two damn white guys, has written a children's book and three books in the epic space adventure series, and... has just released a new provocative book called Beyond the Known, How Exploration Created the Modern World and Will Take Us to the Stars. With all that, he's made a little bit of time to talk with us today. So thanks for taking the time, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Now, I got to start off here. Now, we're just reading through all of your titles and accolades, and we just have to understand here, are you or do you know the most interesting man in the world? Are you him? Are you he? Or do you at least hang out with him?
I think I've submitted my application because he retired, right? So they're looking for a new one.
I assume so. Yeah,
you could fill the role for sure.
I mean, the amount of things you're involved in with, you know, book writing, podcasting, you know, working with SpaceX, you know, being buds with Elon Musk, the whole thing. I mean, it's amazing. So, you know, how did you get to these lofty positions? I guess you can pick which one you like to talk about the most.
Well, I've always been interested in history and aerospace, I guess. So, I mean, the book really comes from almost more of a history place, but I kind of combined them together, wrote about what I know about. But I guess aerospace engineering, I was just really interested in learning. I like learning things, I guess. I really like trivia, so that's another possible answer to the question. I've done a lot of trivia competitions. So, yeah, I don't know. I just really like learning things and sharing my passion with the world.
So when you're in a town, you're on my team for a trivia contest. That's for sure then.
Yeah, no problem.
I got dibs.
That's rude.
Well,
yeah. You don't need two astronomy people on a team. You should be on my team. I could do pop culture.
That's true. We need the pop culture one. All right. Well, so yeah, but you would fit. Yeah, there would be plenty of place for you on the team. So.
Oh man. So speaking of, you said you like trivia and one of the interesting things about you is that you won a reality TV show. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. In Canada, it was the biggest one on the Discovery Channel in Canada. It's called Canada's Greatest Know-It-All. And it's not exactly what it sounds like. It sounds like trivia, but it's really not.
It does.
It's more like competitive Mythbusters. So it's actually really be better called Do It All. It's a lot of building things, engineering stuff. You have to build like a cannon. Well, some of it's jumping out of a plane and scrambling letters on the airfield. Some of it's diving under scuba diving and defusing a bomb before it goes off and communicating a code. But it's problem solving, really. It's solving a lot of problems that they give you. You wake up and every day they take you blindfolded to a new location. And you just do the best you can with kind of the challenge you're presented. One was like a murder mystery you have to solve.
So is the elimination, like it sounds like some of these things would be like, okay.
It's literally Survivor Mythbusters. Survivor. So you have two teams every competition, and the teams vote their weakest member off into elimination, and then there's a final competition to see which one of the two gets eliminated.
So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we need that in America. That's very cool. That's, we call that MacGyver. This MacGyver. That's who we're talking to.
Oh, my gosh.
Now competitive MacGyver. Yeah. Totally. Actually, I can't understand why this hasn't totally taken off in America. I think there's a huge opportunity. So if anyone's listening wants to do a TV show,
call me.
But this would be an amazing. I mean, it's like so American too, right? Like it's got the elimination, competition. It's got the proven you know it more than other people.
Americans love that.
Yeah.
No doubt.
All those things, actually.
All right, we're going to have to pitch that to some people. Right. Of course, we don't know anybody. But.
Darn it.
Getting to your book, Beyond the Known, How Exploration Created the Modern World and Will Take Us to the Stars. It's a great read. You start with some of the, just our drive to be explorers. And we look at, when we're looking back at kind of the history of exploration, did you find some kind of, stories from the old exploration days that were surprising or some new twists or favorite explorers you have from the past?
I did. I was trying to actually capture as much non-European material as possible. I mean, the traditional narrative of exploration is sort of Europe goes out into the world and conquers everybody, basically, mm-hmm. creating our modern world. And that is part of the story, and that is sort of part of one of the sections of the book, I think. But there's a whole other story of how the world was really connected by the people of the Indian Ocean. I think the center of the world was the Indian Ocean for thousands of years. You have people from Egypt, you have people from India, from East Africa, from China, from Southeast Asia, and they're really creating this commercial hub for thousands of years. And the age of exploration with Europeans coming out into the world was actually motivated by Europe's remoteness from this real center of the world, and they were trying to break into an area that they were excluded from. And if you look at at the start of the age of exploration, Europe did not have a technical superiority over India and China and these places, and actually was economically quite inferior. And this is totally, I think, flipping the story of European exploration on its head, because Europe was this sort of this outlier that came into this market and sort of decided to try to take over. And this, by doing so, this created all the incentives that drove European technology. And I think it went hand in hand with the scientific revolution, because there's a lot of hypotheses they were testing about exploration, and they were learning about the world. They're like, oh, well, it's kind of an experiment on forms of government and ways of running cultures and ways of running economies. The stock market basically was created to support the Dutch East India Company, and banks and insurance and all these European innovations were created to support exploration. So I think a strong case can be made that the reason why the world is the way it is today is because of the stimulus generated by these exploratory voyages. So that's definitely one thing. The other thing is, I wanted to try to tell the story of, like, were there any African explorers? Were there any Native American explorers? And obviously there's sparser records, written records, but there is some interesting stuff on that. And particularly with the Polynesians, they were probably the most impressive explorers of all time, settling the Pacific without having advanced technology, which is really impressive. But even like the Incas built seagoing rafts. And possibly reached the Galapagos Islands and definitely used their seafaring abilities for trade along the shore. So there's a lot of stuff that was surprising to me. And I think a strong case can be made that Polynesians probably did reach the Americas. Actually, it's almost obvious that considering how far they went across the Pacific, and the current story is basically they stopped at the very last island, which is Easter Island, which going to the Americas is not that much further. And we're talking about continents that run north to south across the entire world, whereas they found every pinprick of an island in the middle of the Pacific. How could they not? I mean, it's just like almost obvious that they did. Of course, we don't have really hard evidence, so we have to remain skeptical about it. But anyway, that was surprising to me too.
Excuse me. So that is incredible. And I just think shifting gears a little bit from your book, you work for SpaceX, which I think private space travel is so interesting. Can you tell us a little more about that role?
Well, I'm a mission manager, so I interface with NASA. I run a couple of NASA missions. That one is to go and send a spacecraft into an asteroid, and another is to launch a space telescope. So both of these are kind of looking at the future. One's heavily astronomy-based, and one sort of, could we save humanity by diverting an asteroid? Yeah.
Just minor
like,
things, you know?
It was so casual the way you said that. Okay.
Well, and then your book kind of goes on. We'll start that. Your book goes on to kind of go through more modern exploration, space travel, and then even future. I was hoping, since you work with the cutting edge of this stuff, that you'd be able to give us the insight on when teleporters were going to be working.
Oh my gosh. I mean,
is there a working teleporter or a prototype?
I thought you were
prototype?
Kidding about asking.
No, no,
this.
I'm serious. I'm dead serious. Yeah. Is there a working teleporter at SpaceX currently, or how close are you?
Right. Well, it's funny. I see exploration as this whole arc of humanity, and you're right. And I think we're sort of midway along that arc, and I don't think there's actually much of a distinction between what we've done in the past and what we're going to do in the future. And I think this is the main story of the book. It's just we're somewhere along in the middle of the trajectory going into the future. Per the teleporter specifically, I actually think I'm a little bit down on the whole idea of really advanced technology. The whole chapter on interstellar flight, so going to other stars, says yes, it could be done sometime in the future, but don't count on warp drives, don't count on anything that breaks the laws of physics. I think that it's easy to predict or extrapolate from what we know to what could be done within the laws of physics. So maybe hibernation, yes, maybe sublight travel to other stars that takes hundreds of years, maybe even we can get it down eventually maybe to like 50 years with like fusion power or something like that. But beyond that, traveling from star to star like Star Trek, I'm pretty skeptical of, actually. And that
he's
would
so
include,
disappointed now.
That I know. Would include teleporters, unfortunately.
I started off hearing him not say no.
Yeah, you got really, now, like, his eyebrows are like, he's saying there's a chance.
Yeah, but now...
I'm not going to say no. Okay. I don't think you can ever say no about anything. I think that we've, you know, if you'd ask the leading scientists... Well, actually, I don't even know if that's true, because if you asked Leonardo da Vinci, could you ever make an airplane or a helicopter, he'd say, yeah, I have the drawings right here. Basically, so
that's a good point. Yeah,
I don't know.
So hang on to that.
Maybe,
you
there's
never
still
know.
Hope. There's yeah. still hope.
That's well, what no, I no, no. That's what I'm saying. There isn't hope, because Leonardo da Vinci would have. I was going to say, if you asked a scientist 500 years ago to predict the things we have today, they would have said those are impossible. But actually, right. they wouldn't have. Like the leading scientist, like Leonardo da Vinci, was maybe the leading scientist of his day, and he would have said air travel like we have today is perfectly possible. So actually, I'm not sure that's true. So basically, if a scientist tells you that they don't foresee warp drive, it might not happen.
Now I'm totally confused. Yeah. I was hopeful. Now I'm crushed. Now I'm kind of
somewhere in between.
It's Arthur C. Clarke's second law, I think, which is if a distinguished but elderly scientist says something is impossible, he's almost certainly wrong. So if you never say something's impossible, basically,
because they couldn't say what we would be able to do in the future. Like right. Leonardo da Vinci wouldn't be able to say, you can't fly. I just have these drawings. Doesn't mean you can do it. So basically, Dean, get ready for teleportation, bud.
I'm ready. I'm on board.
That's what I heard.
That's what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting to be able to, like, you know, skip traffic, you know, just beam home. It's just going to be, but, you know, we could all dream, I guess.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, Andrew, thanks so much for talking about your book today, and good luck with all your future endeavors. You got so many things going on. We'll be keeping tabs, and thanks so much for taking the time. We've been talking with Andrew Rader, author of Beyond the Known and mission manager at SpaceX.
Well, we haven't done in a while one of our favorite segments, the Crank File. And last month we had, in addition to the transit, calm down,
yeah,
transit.
Yeah.
We also had our Meet a Meteorite night at the observatory. And one question we actually get pretty decently frequently at the observatory is, I think I found a meteorite. And we usually just say, no, you haven't.
Right.
But if somebody thinks they found a meteorite, now you wanted me to pretend like I'd found a rock that I thought was a meteorite, but I'm not going to do that because I know they're so rare.
That's true.
So I know only like 15 have been found in Ohio.
Right, right.
Okay, so yeah. So if people think they have a meteorite, how can they be sure they're not media wrong about it?
Oh, that's good.
I borrowed that from work.
That intro was just for that joke.
Led up to it, then I was like, here it goes. Bam.
Yep. Yep, that is a very common thing we get, especially if it's ever in the news about, you know, falling stars, shooting stars, and meteorites. Everybody thinks they have, or a lot of people think they have one. The story usually goes like this: is grandma or grandpa saw this rock fall on their farm. We've kept it in our family all these years, and I never thought about it, but I thought maybe I'd get it checked out now.
Okay.
We hear that exact story so many times. It's always, it's like grandma or grandpa.
Yeah.
It's just a strange rock that's been in the family and it has this kind of tradition to it. And I really would love to have somebody bring me a real meteorite. I 20 years at the observatory, not one person has brought me an actual space rock.
What would you do if they did bring it to? How would you even react? How would you know to? Are you sure you wouldn't just be like chucking it away? Like, nope. One.
Well, we're thorough. I mean, we can test it out. We, you know, check out its density. We can check out what it's made of.
The density on it.
Right. Yeah, we do called streak tests where we can tell if there's certain elements in it. And then there's also, you can slice it open and see what the inside looks like. And there's definitely some telltale signs if you.
That's nerve wracking.
But 95% of them, we don't even have to go that far.
Oh.
95% of them are like, that's granite. Or, that's limestone. Or,
do you let them finish their story? You're just like, just stop. this is not a meteorite.
I used to be a
get
lot.
Out of here.
I used to be a lot shorter with people. They'd be like, so I got this right. Nope.
You're like, I'm gonna stop you right there.
You know, because the story on this is not gonna. I'm not gonna help. It's not gonna help you.
That's not nice.
No. So I've been more understanding, because you know, people are coming. They really want to learn about this. They really want to know more about it. Initially, I was of the impression that everybody was in there just for financial gain. They wanted a valuable rock in their you know, because they've seen all the antiques road shows and that kind of stuff, and they think, oh, I got this rock, it's from space.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like stinking rich. Like, well, no, you got a piece of slag left over from industrial waste. But
you're like, so close.
That's right. Yeah.
So close.
So the one time that I got a really accurate, most of the time we just say, yeah, that's just a boulder from somewhere else, or it's an unusual rock and it's a little bit different. Somebody brought me in a rock that I identified where he found it just by looking at the rock.
Oh, you'd seen other ones?
I said, okay, where on Eastern Avenue did you find this rock?
Oh.
And he said, how'd you know I found it on Eastern Avenue? Because I pick these rocks up all the time. Yeah. They are not meteorites.
You're like, this is not your retirement plan, my friend.
Sorry. Because he was like, there's a whole bunch of them. I was like, yeah, I know.
Are they like pretty or
they're
something?
They're next to the railroad tracks. They fell off the railroad tracks.
And you know that's what, and it was like, how about we do like, they have like antiques roadshow, like you were saying.
Yeah.
How about we do like bring in your meteorite, antique rock show.
Right.
You bring your boulder or your rock in.
That's right.
We crush your dreams on the spot. Well, and then move on to the next one.
Yeah, and that is the toughest part, is that you have to tell people, no, I'm sorry, it's not. It's just an ordinary rock, or it's a very strange earth rock. Sometimes they're very odd.
Don't that bow. That's nice.
I usually, whether that's true or not, that's what I usually say.
Some of them are probably pretty.
I say, I've never seen one like this before.
So fake,
I know, it was fake. Yeah, I need to work on that too.
Yeah, practice in the mirror.
I think in real world, I make it sound more realistic. Yeah. But yeah, I'm like, I've never seen one like that. That's weird. Oh, man.
Not a meteorite.
Not a meteorite, but very weird.
But weird.
So thanks for bringing it in.
Bye-bye.
But still, there are lots of rocks out there that could be meteorites that we don't know that they are. But
so find them and bring them in.
Is that what we're doing?
Ask for Dean.
I don't
I need Dean to look at this rock right now.
I don't think that was the point of this.
I just made it the point.
Oh, boy. Well, bring him. Yeah, like you said, bring him in. Get ready to be disappointed.
That's right. He's going to crush your dreams so hard. That's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Andrew Rader for joining us. You'll find links to Andrew and his books on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
If you're new to Looking Up, well, welcome. We've done lots of great interviews about space, science, and even some pop culture. You'll find archives of all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
We love talking with guests like Andrew Rader. If there's someone you think we should be talking to, let us know. Our email is lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts. And please give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. Those are incredibly helpful and we really appreciate it.
Our theme song and additional music is by Why, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regis. Keep looking up.